So today we'll pick up where we left off. We had begun to discuss the vacuum structure of non-abelian gauge theory. So we'll finish that up today, and I hope at the end of lecture to give a brief introduction to anomalies, and I'll have a lot more to say about anomalies next week. Okay, so the end of Wednesday's class, I made a claim that for non-abelian gauge theory, which has Euclidean action of 1 over 2 d squared, integral d4, trace of f squared, the gauge field configurations that are pure gauge, that can be just a gauge transformation of the zero gauge field configuration, correspond to the classical vacuum field configurations. And there are barriers between degenerate vacua. And tunneling between those degenerate vacua occurs in essentially the same way as we examined last week when we studied tunneling and ground state energy splitting in quantum mechanics. So if we want to understand the splitting between the degenerate ground states of classical non-abelian gauge theory, we need to find the finite action instanton solutions. Finite action solutions to the equations of motion. So what we want and by finding these finite action instanton solutions in the process, I'll further justify the claim that I made that there is a degenerate set of classical vacua that are separated by potential barriers. Okay, so if we want a finite action solution to the classical equations of motion, just by looking at the form that our action takes, that tells us that since we're integrating over all of space-time, if we want this integral to be finite, well, f should decay sufficiently rapidly for large rho, where, again, rho is the hyper radius. We're working in hyperspherical coordinates. So in particular, we should have that f mu nu goes to 0 as rho goes to infinity, at least as fast as 1 over, faster than 1 over rho squared. Go to hyperspherical coordinates. Here we've got a rho cubed d rho. If we had a 1 over rho squared for each of the f's, that would be a integral rho, d rho over rho, which diverges logarithmically. We have additional factors of 1 over rho, then we'll at least have a chance of having a finite integral. So that tells us that f mu nu should be order 1 over rho cubed. But what we're looking for are the gauge field configurations. And the gauge field configurations, so f is related to the gauge field. Well, there are several terms. So there's a term that involves the derivative of the gauge field. And there's also terms that involve the gauge field square. So we're dealing with non-abelian gauge theory. And in both of those cases, so if a mu is order 1 over rho squared, a derivative will give us an extra factor of 1 over rho, so the dA terms will be order 1 over rho cubed if A is order 1 over rho squared, and the A squared terms will be order 1 over rho to the fourth, so those will be subleading. So if we have A mu 1 over rho squared, then our action will be finite. Well, if we do a gauge transformation of A, that corresponds to the same physical configuration. So those gauge transforms A's should also have the same action as any gauge field configuration that is of this form. So imposing that A mu is order 1 over rho squared is actually too strong a condition. It should be, we should be able to put A mu in a form that looks like 1 over rho squared after our gauge transformation. So in general, the gauge field configurations that will give us a finite action solution should be like 1 over rho squared up to a gauge transformation. Where U, it here is some element of our gauge group. Now, we want our gauge transformations to be well-defined. So in particular, they should have a limit as rho goes to infinity, which tells us that U should be order rho to the zero. If it's growing, then it's not going to have a well-defined limit as rho goes to infinity. So just to make things well-defined, U should basically approach a constant as rho goes to infinity, which essentially tells us that U as rho goes to infinity is just of some function of the angles. So we should get a definite answer if we go to infinity in any direction. So up to subleading terms, U should just be U of x should be a function of the angles only. And so what we see here is that every finite action gauge field configuration is associated with some U of x, so some gauge field configuration that's a function of the angles only. But not necessarily uniquely. There might be multiple different U of x hats that give the same, lead to the same action. And in fact, that's what we'll see. Okay. So, as Ivan was asking last class, a natural question to ask is, why can't we just undo this and do a gauge transformation to map all of these finite action gauge field configurations to the same thing? And so let's look at what happens if we do a gauge transformation on an A that's of this form. So we do a gauge transformation. A goes to H inverse plus I H d mu H inverse, which, if A is of this form, is I H U inverse H U inverse plus some term that's of order 1 over rho squared. And so if H U was equal to 1 as rho goes to infinity, then we could remove this term. And we could forget about this term and just deal with this term. But this is generally not possible. To find an H that is continuous that satisfies this equation. And the reason for that is there are topological obstructions. So I'll come back to the four-dimensional case because it's slightly more involved than the two-dimensional case. But the ideas are essentially the same. So first, what we're going to do is go through the same arguments, basically study the vacuum structure of abelian gauge theory in two dimensions. And we'll see that there are very close analogs to non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions. So let's repeat the same arguments we did before in this slightly simpler case. So what we're looking for are definite action gauge field configurations for d equals 2, abelian gauge theory. So what we would change is we'd change this 4 to 2. We don't need a trace. We've got abelian gauge theory. So the first question we need to ask is how should f decay as r, the radius in polar coordinates of our two-dimensional space, goes to infinity? If we want this integral to be finite, so it should decay sufficiently quickly, which means it should go as 1 over r to some power, what should that bar be? What should n be?
1 over r.
So if it's 1 over r, then we've got a 1 over r squared here. This is r dr, so that will diverge logarithmically. So we need to go to the next power. Then we'll get something finite. 1 over, we'll have 1 over r to the fourth from the integrand, r dr from the measure should be finite. And that tells us then that a mu should be order 1 over r, because f is related to a by taking derivative of a. Again, plus up to a gauge transformation. Do a gauge transformation of, we're not going to change the action. And so, and again, we should have that U as rho r goes to infinity should be just a function of the angles. So that means, so here U is an element of our abelian gauge group. So it just takes the form e to the I alpha of x in general, but it's only a function of the angle, not the radial coordinate in this limit. So u is just takes this form. So u here is a map from angle to the group U1. But this angle just parameterizes a point on a circle. So another way of saying this is a map from the circle to the group U1, which is just the circle. An element of U1 is just a point on the circle specified by some phase. So in order to understand the gauge field configurations that have finite action, we need to understand the maps from the circle to the circle. And there are some simple ways we can map the circle to the circle. One of the simplest ways we can do is we can, things we can do is we can have a map we'll call U0 of theta, which just maps everything onto the identity. We can also have, there's another very easy map to identify, which is just the identity map. You map E, the angle theta, to the angle theta. And there, if we wanted to extend this, there are other maps we could do. We could do a map that winds nu times, which I'll call U nu of theta. It's just e to the I nu theta. So these maps, so if we've got a mapping the circle, and so we're mapping basically the top half of the circle to the entire circle as if nu is equal to 2. The top half of the circle gets mapped to the entire circle as theta goes from 0 to pi, e to the I nu theta winds around the unit circle one time, and the other half is also mapped to the whole circle. So these maps are just maps that map the unit circle to a map that winds around the unit circle nu times. So this works as long as nu is an integer.
So I don't see why we have like just the half of the circle and then we're going to map it to the entire circle. Like, I don't see.
So if theta is equal to 0, that's mapped to 1. Theta is equal to pi over 2 is mapped to minus 1. And anything in between will be mapped to somewhere in the top half of the circle. And theta equals pi is again mapped back to 1 if nu is equal to 2. So in that sense, when theta, so the circle corresponds to theta going from 0 to 2 pi. And on this left-hand side of the equation, on the right-hand side of the equation, this is always a point on the unit circle. And so as you vary theta from 0 to pi, we've already wrapped around the unit circle once, if nu is equal to 2. And as theta goes from pi to 2 pi, it wraps around the circle again. So in that sense, this map with nu equals 2 wraps around, maps top half to the full circle and the bottom half to the full circle. So it, as you go around once, on this side of the equation, you're going around twice on this side of the equation. And as may be plausible and can be proven, but I won't prove it here. Any can be shown that any map from the circle to the circle is continuously deformable to one of these maps. And any two maps that are continuously deformable to one another are said to be homotopic. And so every map from the circle to the circle is homotopic to exactly one of these standard mappings. And these standard mappings are not homotopic to each other. They cannot be continuously deformed to one another. As could be intuitive, we can think about these mappings as like winding a string around a circle. You can deform the, and if we label the string as going from 0 to 2 pi, we can move around the string, but if we tie the ends together, there's no way we can undo a winding without breaking the string. So this shows that these gauge field configurations are not continuously deformable into one another.
Sorry, homotopy is that is continuously deformable, or what is homotopy? I don't know the
concept. So we can imagine, so if I take this map that maps the circle to this point, maps every, okay, let me do this. So this is a map. So here's u0 of theta versus theta. And it maps everything. Let's just look at the argument. This is always something on the unit circle, so let's take the log. The log of this. So we're mapping everything and divide by I. So we're mapping everything to, in this map, we're mapping everything to theta equals 0. So theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. And this is our map. And we can imagine doing a continuous deformation means we just take this function and deform it a little bit. So we could, instead of taking this map, we could continuously deform it to a map that does something like this. I can sketch functions that are infinitesimally close to the original map, and by doing a series of small deformations, I can get from this map to this map. So these two maps be homotopic. And in terms of this picture of mapping the circle to this point, this would correspond to a map that maps the circle to starting at this point, goes up here, and then goes back down. So those maps are homotopic.
Homotopy? Yeah, it's like putting them in the axis of the formations, continuous formations.
That's right. But there's no way I can do a continuous deformation between the map that maps everything to this point to a map that wraps around once. It has to jump. It has to go all the way around. So if I do a continuous deformation, I'm just doing a small deformation, and wherever I'm going, I've got to come back to where I started. Or can imagine tying a string that's labeled from 0 to 2 pi around a circle. There's no way you can deform that to the string being detached from the, or there's no way you can bring every part of the string over to a single point.
But that continues the formation, I mean, that notion of homotopy is relative to the endpoints, right? So it requires that at the beginning and at the end, we are at the same point.
Yes, we're requiring our maps to be.
Why can't we? So in the spirit of Lie algebras, however, we can deform between one another is the map alpha of theta, right? Alpha of theta in those mappings are the neus times theta, right? And I could just reform nu however I want. Of course, I won't be at the same endpoints, right? My endpoints would be fixed. But what's the problem of like not keeping your endpoints fixed? Why do we want the u's to coincide all between one another at the endpoints?
We're essentially mapping the boundary of space-time to an element of our gauge group. So if we're going to interpret theta as an angle in space-time, theta should be periodic. We go theta equals 0 and theta equals 2 pi refer to the same physical direction in space-time. So we should get the same.
Oh, okay.
So these standard maps. So we can recover nu from this standard map using this nice formula. So nu 1 over 2 pi integral 2 pi d theta, u dd theta, u inverse. And if we plug in u equals u nu into this formula, we just get so here we get a e to the I nu theta minus I nu e to the minus I nu theta. These exponentials cancel, and the minus I cancels with the I. The integral over theta cancels the 2 pi, and we're just left with the nu. So for the standard maps, we can recover nu if we know u. And in fact, this formula is general. It works. It gives us the winding number for any map, regardless of whether it's in the form of one of our standard maps or not. And this shows us, we can see more explicitly that these standard maps are not deformable into one another. Because if we try to do an infinitesimal deformation of u, we can show that nu doesn't change. So if we do an infinitesimal deformation of u, so u goes to u plus some small change in the function u, the integrand in that formula for the winding number, nu changes to u. So we get the original, what we started with, plus we could perturb, if we're just working to linear order in the perturbation, get a term du, d theta, u inverse, or this u could be deformed. So then we get a minus u, d theta, deformation in u inverse is u inverse du u inverse, and related to the original deformation like that. And we can simplify this. So first term doesn't change. If we act with this derivative on u inverse du u inverse, we get three different terms. So we'll get one term where the derivative is just acting u inverse, delta u inverse. We also get a term that is the derivative's acting on u inverse, then the u and u inverse cancel. We have d theta delta u inverse. And we also have a term where the d theta acts on the last u inverse. In that case, the u and u inverse cancel again. And we just have delta u times u inverse, which cancels this term. We have 1 minus 1 times this term. And so these two terms can be combined. And you can write them just as d theta of u inverse times delta u. So if we act the derivative on the u inverse, we get this term. On du, we'll get this other term. And this is just a total derivative, which will vanish on integration. So integrate from 0 to 2 pi. This term vanishes. So this shows that the winding number, nu, is invariant under small deformations. And therefore, these standard maps are not continuously deformable or are not homotopic to one another. So there's this class of maps that are not continuously deformable to one another. And this also shows, so what we were studying was the finite action gauge configurations, but this also shows that the vacuum field configurations are not continuously deformable into one another. So the only difference between these finite action configurations and the vacuum configurations is just the first term, the O, 1 over R term should be absent for the vacuum configurations. The vacuum configurations are just the ones that are gauge transformations of the zero gauge field configuration. Okay. So another observation we can see rather straightforward manner from our standard maps is that the winding number is additive. So in particular, if we're interested in some map that's the product of two other maps, then the winding number of this map should just be the sum of the winding numbers of the other maps. As can be seen just from the explicit formula. Just multiply the exponentials, we add the exponents. So this tells us that instantons can change the winding number. So if we start with some gauge, vacuum gauge field configuration, and we multiply it by an instanton configuration that has some winding number, the resulting vacuum configuration will have a different winding number by this formula. Yes.
Is that physically meaningful?
It is physically meaningful. So if you recall from the periodic potential we studied last week, that was a situation where we had a infinite set of degenerate classical ground states, or classical vacua. And the picture we had there was that instantons mediated tunneling from one vacuum to another. And because of that tunneling from one vacuum to another, it was mediated by instantons, the ground state energy was split. We looked at that in lecture and some more in tutorial. So the same idea is true here. So we've identified a infinite set of classical vacua, which are indexed by the winding number, and instantons mediate tunneling between those classical vacua and cause the ground state energy to split.
Is there some generality that instantons will be classified by this deformation classes?
Yes, I'll have more to say about that when we go back to four dimensions in just a few minutes. Another parenthetical remark. It'll be important later, next week, is that there's another formula you can write for nu. I won't go through the algebra, it's in the lecture notes, but I just want to say a few comments about why it's important. So some algebraic manipulation, you can change this formula here into this formula. So you can write it instead of in terms of u, this element of the gauge group, you can write the winding number in terms of the field strength. And as we'll see, the integrand in this formula is related to the chiral anomaly. So there's no real physics in between the formula we have here and here. Just if we plug in the definition of A and F, you can, after half a board of algebra, get this formula. But this result is important because it shows there's a relationship between these instantons that we've been studying and the anomalies we're going to study next.
Yes.
So just because, so in QFT, usually when you have a vacuum and another vacuum, you're used to saying that there's like a probability zero of going from a sector to another sector.
Yes.
So are you saying that like in some way, if like you have a lower energy vacuum, for example, an instanton would be a way to like overcome this in a couple of sectors?
I'm not saying that, no. So in when we studied the periodic potential,
yeah,
we had a classically discrete set of, well, it's discrete but an infinite set of minima. And those were not energy eigenstates. The energy eigenstates were superpositions of all of those classical macro. The same thing is true here. So these instantons mediate tunneling between the classical vacua. The classical vacua are not energy eigenstates. The energy eigenstates are superposition of all of the classical vacua. And so if you're going to do quantum mechanics, you need to do quantum mechanics around some quantum vacuum. These, and what you said is true, that once we choose one of those quantum vacuum, there's no transitions to another one, at least in the infinite volume limit. But that's not inconsistent with the statement I made before, that the instantons mediate tunneling between the classical vacuum.
Okay, so are you saying that the quantum vacuum is like a superposition of the classical one?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So we've looked at abelian gauge theory in two dimensions. Most often we're interested in working in four dimensions, so let's see what changes when we go to d=4. And simplicity, let's first study the case, the simplest non-abelian gauge group, SU2. So let's see what changes. So we're interested in finding the finite action gauge field configurations, both to figure out what the classical vacua are and what the instantons are that mediate tunneling between those classical vacua. And to do that, we need to figure out what are the possible u that are just a function of the angles. So for SU2, u is just e to the I lambda I times sigma I over 2, which can also be written as A times the identity plus I times BI times the identity. Basically, if you Taylor expand this, any polynomial in the sigma matrices can be rewritten as just a single sigma matrix. So we can write general element of SU2 like this, or the identity, or AI and BI real. And well, the fact that U is unitary puts a constraint on the AIs. So that tells us that A squared plus BI BI is 1. And this is just the equation for a 3-sphere. So one of the key differences between what we did before, two dimensions for abelian gauge theory and for four dimensions for SU2 gauge theory, is that what we need to look for are the classification of maps from the 3-sphere. So same argument that U should just be at large radius should just be a function of the angles, carries over. So now the boundary of four-dimensional space-time is just a three-sphere. So we want to map from the three-sphere at rho equals infinity to the three-sphere that is SU2. You can think of the SU2 as also three-sphere. And like before, there are a set of standard maps. That basically just correspond to mapping three sphere to itself or itself wrapped around new times. And like in two dimensions, the winding number can be written, can be recovered from any map. There's a formula you can write that just write it so you can see what it looks like. It's more complicated than the previous case, but it is useful to, given a map, be able to compute the nu, which standard map it's homotopic to. The formula is more complicated, which is why I discussed the two-dimensional case first. And like before, although it's a bit more algebra than in the two-dimensional case, nu can be related to the gauge field. And this formula is important. This will show up in our discussion next week when we discuss anomalies. And exactly like before, this integrand here is going to be the anomaly that we're going to study next. So we'll come across this integrand repeatedly next week. Okay, so that's the story for four-dimensional SU2 gauge theory. Essentially the same as two-dimensional U1 gauge theory. Formulas are a bit more involved. So we can ask, now, what would happen if we're interested in a different gauge theory in four dimensions? So there are essentially two other cases. So for U1, gauge theory in four dimensions, there's no analog of winding number. And that's because all maps from spatial infinity, from the three sphere at spatial infinity to U1 or the circle are deformable to the trivial map. And for any other simple compact group, there's a theorem that tells us that it basically reduces to the SU2 case. And that theorem basically states that all of the maps from the three sphere to a group, a simple non-abelian Lie group, can be deformed to a map from S3, from the free sphere, to an SU2 subgroup of that group. So in other words, it's just the same as before. So for any non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions, it's essentially the same. And so it can be, I've alluded to this several times in responding to Elliot's questions. But it can be shown that the theta vacua, the energy eigenstates, are just superpositions of the gauge field configurations with definite winding number. And that if you compute, you want to ask what's the transition from one of these energy eigenstates to another one. What you would want to compute is the limit as t goes to infinity, theta prime e to the minus ht theta. And well, this is just the limit t goes to infinity, sum over n and m to the minus ht m e to the n theta prime minus m theta. This amplitude here . So if we want to change from a gauge field configuration with winding number m to n, the way to do that is by using an instanton or combination of instantons which have total winding number n minus m. So we want to, so those those instantons are basically the saddles of this path integral, and so sorry. Skip this stuff here. Write this as sum over n e to the I n theta prime minus theta, and then instead of summing over m, let's sum over n minus m. That should be nu. Nu is n minus m. So we've done essentially a change of our summation variables. And so we're left with a factor of e to the I nu theta. And then we should sum over, integrate over gauge field configurations which have winding number nu. And so this sum front of n is going to give us a delta theta minus theta prime, which shows us that there's no transitions between the different theta vacua. And well, this looks like our usual functional integral for gauge theory, except there's this extra term, nu theta, which we can write in this way in terms of the gauge field strength. This is a new term we could add to our action. So we rewrite nu like this. That's an extra term. It's gauge invariant. We could have considered as an extra contribution to the action. And it can have important physical effects. We neglected this term in QFT2, but in general, it's allowed. And can have interesting effects that I'll discuss more next week. So this term here is an extra term. Other questions on this? Oh,
I think I have two questions. The first one is, can I interpret this extra term as a chemical potential term?
Possibly, I haven't thought about that before.
Second question is, if I act on two different theta vacua with a local operator, is this correlation function still going to be zero?
Yes, it'll still be.
Okay.
It'll still be zero. Are there other questions on instantons? So next week, we'll move on to anomalies, and I'll tell you why Noether's theorem is a lie.